Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins.
And we were like, ooh, this is good. And then it sucked. It was like not a good script at all. We were like, oh man, this does not work.
Welcome to SinCast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the SinCast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Jonathan Watkins from CinemaSins.
Hello, hello.
Today we have a very special guest. It's director Aaron B. Kuntz, who is coming out with the movie The Pale Door on August 21st. It's going to be in some theaters, I think, and VOD on August 21st. Welcome, Aaron Kuntz.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. Jonathan, it's a pleasure to be here. I got to say, I'm nervous. You go on CinemaSins, you make an indie film, you go on CinemaSins, you're like, oh God, what is this going to mean? So, but no, I'm excited. I'm excited to talk.
Yeah, we're just gonna live send your movie if that's cool. So.
yeah.
Minute one. No, I'm
kidding. It is a strange thing at times because we do a YouTube channel for fun where we're total assholes, and then we do podcast where we are not assholes at all, and we show you how much we love.
Know, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah, you're right. It is debatable, but.
Well, I'm sure you guys have encountered this, though. There's no one on the planet who could do a CinemaSin better than a filmmaker on his own movie. So I'll just say that. As well as you all do it, trust me, we know every little thing that we're trying to hide. We know every little thing that we're like, wait a second. God, I hope they don't notice that. Well, how do we shift this properly to kind of like divert the eyes from it that you all still find? But, you know, so we know. So trust me, I could do my own CinemaSins on movies.
I bet.
Well, and yeah, I mean, that comes from watching the movie literally 100 times. While you're trying to get it prepared for release, right?
Yeah. Well, and I also was one of the editors on the film and the producer, writer. Yeah. So this has been this whole movie's been a crazy journey. But, I guess we'll get into that.
Yeah. We will talk about The Pale Door, but I watched that sci-fi movie that you made called Camera Obscura earlier. And, tell me about your experience on that film, because it's an interesting premise for sure. I had fun with it, but if you have some sort of experience you'd like to share on that, I'm all ears.
Yeah, I've alluded to this with a number of folks, but yeah, I mean, that was quite literally the most difficult, you know, filmmaking process I've ever had. And I even considered quitting after making the movie. It was that tough. So yeah, you know, look, I think it was my first feature. We tried for years to get that thing made. I mean, the financing came through and fell through, I think at least 4 different times. Mm-hmm. And then the movie that was released was not even my cut of the film. There's a version of it on the Oprah network or something, and I don't even know why it's there. And that's some other version. There's the ending, like there's a whole like beginning part that should have been at the end and like is now put at the front. And there's just so many weird things that happen on that. And I don't get me wrong, I mean, I think I made plenty of mistakes. I'm proud of a lot was there. I think I had a wonderful cast. I had wonderful people that I work with and a wonderful crew. I think it was probably a little too much for me to bit off a little bit more than I should chew as a first feature, but there's still a lot of moments that I'm really proud of. And I had a lot of fun making it in those aspects, but yeah, you know, I mean, getting any films made and it, look, I will say I'm lucky, you know, I'm a very, very lucky person and I know that. And I'm fortunate that I have the Jerry Goldsmith Q and that Universal logo that curves around, you know, the globe. Like that's, that gives me chills every time. Then after that, I start to slowly deteriorate and die inside after that moment. But, you know, but then there's still moments. Like there's like a, like, I love what Christopher Denham did. I love, you know, the kind of unhinged level that he had. And
yeah.
You know, there's some great violence and well, it depends which cut you saw, depending on which violence you saw.
I saw some pretty heady violence, and that's that was not a pun that I intended, but I saw some heady violence in that movie. There is a shot, and please tell me that you're proud of this shot. I guess I won't spoil everything here. Just let people kind of know. There's a character that's killing another character with a weight, a barbell weight or whatever. and while he does that, while he just hits, you know, punches this guy in the face with it, the camera spins around and basically says, you know what, this is probably just a little bit too much for anybody to handle. And you know, it's effective in that way where you imagine it, you know, you imagine the violence going on screen and everything. So I love that part.
No, I appreciate you bringing that up. Actually, so there's a couple shots like that I'm really proud of that we pulled off. And that was one where, you know, I didn't want it to, it's, I mean, everything I do is going to have some level of gratuitousness to it because that's just part of my style. Mm-hmm. But there's also, you're crossing a threshold where that's a serious film. And it's also dealing with someone with mental illness, you know, who's dealing with, like, you know, PTSD and all this and like kind of how that comes together. So we, you know, I had this idea of doing that kind of like, you know, 360 shot. But what was so tough about that was, it starts clean and Denham doesn't have any blood on him and he's got this and we've got the normal guy there. Then mm-hmm. when you start to spin the camera around, you have to get that guy out, bring in the dummy that's all messed up. Then we're spraying blood in, you know, Christopher Denham's face, who, by the way, he was like, we're like, well, how are we going to do this? We have to like sneak in. He's like, well, why don't you just have, when the guy sits down, put blood in his mouth and have him spit it on me? And I'm like, Chris, oh my God. Like, no, I'm not going to make, his name's Charlie Talbert, who, by the way, that guy, that creepy guy,
yeah,
is the dude from Angus.
Oh no, Angus? No way.
Oh, no kidding.
How no way.
Yeah. So that's part of the reason why I cast him. Cause I wanted to kill the dude from Angus and make him like this masturbatory creep. So
I had no idea.
Completely ruined my childhood, but his name's Charlie Talbert. He's a wonderful actor. Was in like The Big Short and stuff like mm-hmm. that.
Yeah.
And he's just like, I'll spit in your face. Yeah, no problem. I'll spit blood in your face. No problem. But
imagine doing that in 2020.
Yeah. Oh God.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, but I was proud of that shot. It's a fun shot. And just, you know, there's a really good one-er that we had where we go in a police station, follow, come out of a police station, come back in. And that was really difficult. And so there were these moments that we got to flourish. And when I had a great crew. So the times when I got to really do it the way I wanted to, I thought we had some fun moments. It was just the rest of the stuff that I wasn't really given some of the freedom that I would have liked.
Yeah. I guess that's a common tale, especially when you're making your first movie. You don't have the, you know, I guess the power or the wherewithal to know what to do, what to fight for, and everything like that. And it's a learning experience, I'm assuming.
No, that's a great way of putting it, because even though I technically had Final Cut, my Final Cut somehow does not exist on any of the versions that are out there. Mm-hmm. Not sure how that happened, but that's because I just didn't think on how to fight back. Like I thought I was really, and I was lucky and I am lucky. And I was like, well, look, I'm just glad to have this experience. Like maybe I don't want to ruffle feathers. I don't want to push back on this. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do that. And I didn't stand my ground and don't get me wrong, I made plenty of mistakes myself, but mm-hmm. I didn't stand my ground in the way that I should. And then we made a film after that called Scare Package, which is just like over the top horror comedy thing. That's like mm-hmm. the opposite. That's just a lot of fun. And that was kind of the counter. It was like, can we just get back to like why I love making movies? Let's just do this with our friends. Let's just throw a bunch of blood around. Let's have fun. Let's have mm-hmm. fun doing this. And then that kind of, you know, got us back onto the journey and kind of course corrected. And we also learned what we were capable of too. You know, we learned, you know, there were too many locations in that movie. There were 27 locations in Camera Obscura. Oh, that's wow. Stupid. That's stupid. You don't make an indie film with 27 locations.
Yeah.
You know, you just don't do it because you don't have time, you know, to make that happen. So, you know, we just had to figure that out. And then, you know, I mean, Scare Package being done in pieces, but then the Pale Door was like the opposite. It's like, get to one place, stay there, you know, mm-hmm. as long as you can. So, but yeah.
The Scare Package. Now you, it's just Scare Package, not the Scare Package. Somebody dropped the later on, but no, in Scare Package, I believe that, has that been on Shudder? Is that?
Yeah, it's a Shudder original. We released like June 18th on Shudder.
Yeah, actually. I watched the Joe Bob, the last drive-in episode where he premiered that. That was a lot of fun.
That was a surreal moment. Yeah.
I bet.
Yeah. That was so, I mean, growing up being a horror fan, and I wasn't allowed to watch horror movies. But I got, you know, we had TNT, so I could mm-hmm. watch Monster Vision. Mm-hmm. And so Joe Bob was like kind of my education in horror. And I wrote him in that movie because he, you know, spoilers, whatever, it's fine. It's been out. You should go watch it on Shudder if you haven't. But he shows up in the film. And I wrote him in the movie because this was before he had had the Shudder show, before the last drive-in had come back, before any mm-hmm. of that stuff had happened, just because I love Joe Bob, you know, and I just thought it'd be fun. And then he had this resurgence and it kind of all kind of came together. But I mean, I directed the dude. I consider John a friend, John Bloom, mm-hmm. You know, a friend. But I got to say, on June 12th, when that premiered, and we weren't allowed to tell anybody, like I knew it was coming, we weren't allowed to tell anyone. But God, that night, seeing Joe Bob talk about the movie, say my name, and then to say, you know, 4 stars, Joe Bob says, check it out. I legitimately got teary-eyed. Yeah.
I can't even imagine for like anyone that grew up on him getting a film on that, on one of his shows and getting to hear the drive-in totals.
That was amazing.
That's gotta be like just one of those, like, you know, highlights of a career. If you were a fan of his, I know it would be for me. Cause like you, I even watched him on the movie channel. Like, yeah. I remember as far back as when he was doing that. And, but yeah, no, that was a lot of fun watching that. And I think you and some other people maybe were tweeting that night.
So with that film, so my company made the whole film, I produced all of it. And then I wrote and directed the core segment and the mm-hmm. finale, which is about 40% or so of the movie. But the other filmmakers, you know, we brought together and we told them like, hey, it's going to happen Friday, June 12th. Cause everybody thought the movie was premiering June 18th. Mm-hmm. So this was like a big surprise and nobody was allowed to know. So we were all prepared. And I was tweeting all night about it. And my Twitter app actually crashed because so many people contacted me like, what the hell? You're on the last drive-in? I mean, it was just complete and utter chaos. And that's such a special night. Like that's
now you know how Diana Prince feels every Friday night when her Twitter crashes.
Fun.
And that's supposed to come out on Blu-ray in October, right? Like October 20th, I think.
Something. Yeah. So yeah, Blu-ray, DVD, October 20th, and it'll also be on regular VOD at that time as well, outside of Shudder. But just time for Halloween, and we have a ton of like fun stuff. In fact, you guys will appreciate this. We did a commentary track for it, and I think the way I phrased the commentary, I was like, "Look, guys, if we do this release, I want everything to be self-referential." And I think the name of the commentary track is, you know, filmmaker commenting that comments on other films better than this commentary track or something like that. It's like, I can't remember, it's so convoluted. But I was like, the whole movie's convoluted. That's kind of the whole point. So it was a lot of fun to do. And then we've got bonus scenes and extra. There's a whole segment that wasn't in the movie and stuff too.
Oh, that's cool. I'm looking forward to checking that out. That's one of those movies that was, you could just tell the love that it was made with, from everybody involved. I mean, you guys knew the genre very well, loved the genre. I really quite enjoyed Noah Segan's, segment in there. I know was that his directorial debut?
It was. Okay. Yeah. Noah's been a long time friend. We met on Starry Eyes, which I was a producer on, and so kind of got to know him there. And we've always talked about, and he was in Camera Obscura, of course. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he knew I was making this and he's like, hey man, you should let me direct. And I'm like, what? Like, I didn't know you direct, you know, I knew he was writing something, but he's like, yeah, I want to do this. I have this idea. And he, him and this guy, Frank Garcia Hell, is this hilarious guy in from like the UCB scene and all that, comedian. And they wrote this like really great takedown on toxic masculinity, like mm-hmm. via werewolves. And I was just cracking up through the whole time. I mean, I wasn't able to be on set for that one, but my producer Sean was, and he's just like, he was sending me stuff the whole time. He's like, dude, we can't even do takes. We're all laughing so much as this is going on, which was the whole movie was like that, you know? I mean, yeah. The whole movie was just, because again, coming off Camera Obscura, where you feel beaten down, you feel like my whole dream, you know, I left a very lucrative career in the game, in like tech industry, you know, and I left it to make movies, and, you know, and I still don't make the money that I used to make in that industry, but yeah. That's okay. It doesn't matter because this is what I wanted to do. So to give everything up and, you know, like to put everything on the line and to make this first film and have it be so many things were so troubling about that and difficult. And I didn't tell anybody for the longest time. I thought that felt like an excuse, you know? So I just kind of stayed quiet and just kind of, you know, wrote this. And my girlfriend at the time was like, you kind of sold your soul to the devil to make your first movie, didn't you? And I'm like, oh my God, I did, didn't I? So coming off of that, it was, well, how do we just get back? We had made short films and had fun doing those and had met all these short filmmakers. And I was like, let's just like scrape away everything. Let's do 100% independent. Let's just get money from our friends. I put a lot of my personal money in. Let's just figure this shit out and just do it. And just throw around as much blood as possible. Let's just cast the people that we love and just, you know, let it come from a place of heart and make fun of horror, but like bear hug it at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's what it became. And it's, you know, it's so crazy just to see the response, and it's been a huge hit on Shudder. And, so yeah, we're super excited, and I feel really, really lucky to have had that experience.
And so that sort of cleansed the palate, and you were able to look on the bright side again, and you made The Pale Door, from that. I find this type of thing invigorating when you take two different genres that you would never, think of as going together at all, and then making a movie like this. You know, obviously a lot of From Dusk Till Dawn was something that came to mind during this film, but you know, combining westerns with witches is already a fun sort of gamut that you're doing here. Where did you start on this? Did you go out and seek out to, let's do some sort of genre mixing type of thing? Or did you say, hey, I want to do a movie about witches, and it turned into a Western, or vice versa? How did that come about?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first off, we, with my company, Paper Street Pictures, like we try to make genre mashups. Like that's actually a goal of ours.
Oh yeah.
Is to take horror and mix them with other things. So even Camera Obscura was like the psychological horror. Now that's been done a little more. But then, you know, horror comedy is not done quite as much. Mm-hmm. So that was part of that appealed to us. And then, yeah, horror Western hadn't seen a lot of at all. But that really kind of came about because I just love Westerns, and I wanted to make, a really dark, brooding, violent Western, like a modern violent Western that just got, you know, I thought the characters that you have in Westerns and the kind of like anti-hero sensibilities, and they don't really know who to trust, and like anybody can die at any moment, and they're outlaws, but then they're kind of accepted into society. There's just something that's really, really, really great about what those characters can be, and then what a gang of characters become. And I think when you get a gang of characters and you create these different personalities, that's just so fascinating to me. And I think there's a great, there's just a wonderful way to explore that as a writer. So Cameron Burns and I, who was my co-writer for everything I do pretty much, you know, I was like, let's write this thing. So we wrote this Western. We were really into it. It was super pretentious and dark and brooding. It was called The Play Turned Tragic. And we were like, ooh, this is good. And then it sucked. It was like not a good script at all. We were like, oh man, this does not work. Like this is, you know, it just kind of fell apart at the halfway point, and or maybe even like a third of the way in. And so I kind of had it shelved for a long time. And then we were writing another story that was called The Dark Day, that kind of dealt with like a reimagining of the Salem witch trials. And like, what if like, you know, maybe some real magic came out of these like horrible people, and like that was sitting there. And then after doing Camera Obscura, which oddly enough was kind of a hit internationally for them. And they were like, hey, do you have, you know, another project? We want to do something witch related right now. And Robert Eggers' The Witch had really done well. So like, can you pitch us a witch thing? I was like, hell yeah. I was like, yeah, I got a witch story. Sure. I'm like, we got to come up with a witch story. So I was like, wait a second. Like, I know all this about the Salem Witch Trials. I know this whole thing, you know, with this Western, why don't we do this like witchy Western kind of idea? And we were like, oh, that's really, really cool. Pitch it to Universal. We're so excited. Got this nice little deck. It's all polished. It looks good. And immediately they're like, wait, what? Cowboys? What the? Huh? What is this? This is, we just wanted normal witches, Aaron. Like, what is, and I'm like, what the hell is a normal witch, guys? Like, I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, because Robert Eggers, the witch, is so normal. Like, that's
exactly. Yeah. Like, what Well, this is what happens in Hollywood, right? Like, you go to these pitch meetings, you're like, we're looking for the next Get Out. And I'm like, no, you're not. Yeah. If I had the next Get Out, you wouldn't even know what it was. Okay. Right. That's the whole point here. So, you know, we're doing this. I'm like, that's fine. And don't get me wrong, these are wonderful people. Like, I don't want to speak of, like, I love my relationship with Universal. They've been really great on that. And a lot of the problems that I had were actually not with them. Now, there was some stuff that happened when they released it to their subsidiaries and what happened. But anyway, just wanted to give that caveat. Mm-hmm. So I had this kind of my back pocket. I had this idea of a witchy Western. And then, you know, cut to just a couple of years ago. And I got invited to go on a screenwriting panel in the middle of nowhere, Texas. It's like Beaumont, Texas or something. And they were like, yeah, well, we're trying to get another big name on this, on the panel. I'm like, well, that makes sense. You got me. You need somebody good. So they're like, oh, we got Joe Lansdale and his son, Keith Lansdale. I'm like, what the hell? I'm like, can I sit in the crowd? Cause I don't think I should be on the panel with him. That doesn't make sense. And they're like, no, we want you there. Like, you know, cause I've sold other screenplays and stuff. So they like knew that I had some background in this. And I was like, all right, cool. You know, I'm delighted. And I was there and just had a great time with Joe and Keith and just talking. And I told that story of pitching this witchy Western to Universal. And Joe like stops the middle of this interview. And I still have the audio of this interview, which is like fun to listen to back now. And he's like, whoa, wait, what? Witches and cowboys? Like that's cool. That's a cool idea. And like, that's a horrible Joe impersonation. Joe, if you hear this, I apologize in advance. But you know, he does his like East Texas way of doing it. And it's so great. And I'm like, well, yeah, you know, I mean, I was trying to make a sci-fi film. It's kind of like Cronenberg-y kind of, you know, sci-fi horror thing. And he's like, you should make that. That's what you should be making. And then his son Keith's like, yeah. And then he's like, and then he completely derails the whole thing. He's like, what do you guys think? Shouldn't Aaron be making this movie? And then they're all like, yeah, you should make that. And they're all, I'm like, okay, well, I guess I should be making this. And we went to dinner that night and we talked about it. And I was like, well, you know, I wrote this Western and it had some problems. And I don't think that I'm good at some of the voices that I kind of wanted to tell. And he said, well, let's help you. And, you know, and then Joe was so busy. He didn't really have time to be a full writer, but his son Keith became a full writer on it. And Joe was giving us notes. And next thing I knew, we had written The Pale Door. And it happened really fast after that. I mean, like, what's crazy too, is literally the day, it was like April 20th of 2019. Was the day that I was on the, or excuse me, on 2018, was the day I was on the panel. And then on April 20th, 2019, was the day that I left to drive to set to direct The Pale Door. So it's totally crazy.
Yeah. Totally crazy. The title comes from an Edgar Allan Poe poem, The Haunted Palace. Was this something that you were sort of thinking about before the story even came to fruition, or was it something that was just sort of a happy coincidence, or how does the Edgar Allan Poe poem fit into this other than just the title?
So I have a book of Poe poems and I read it probably every couple of years and I go through and flip through it and just kind of keep it as a coffee table book. And I loved The Haunted Palace. I just thought it was a very haunting story. I guess that's apropos to say The Haunted Palace is a haunted story, but it's just about this town that was no more. And the idea, like this idea of like laugh, but smile no more. I thought it was like a really like creepy term for this and a way of phrasing it. And just this idea of, you know, hiding behind these horrors and like not being the reality of what you see and kind of playing with your mind. And I just thought it was a really great poem. And then, like I said, I like pretentious titles. So it was originally The Play Turned Tragic,
right?
Was that original idea, which was just me playing around with stuff. I don't even know where that came from. so then I was going through, I was trying to think of a title and we'd had nothing, you know, it was just like, it was the witchy Western, you know, it was like the working thing. And then as I was reading that, I was like, whoa, The Pale Door, it's like the pale horse. It kind of evokes a little Western vibe, but then this poem is so appropriate for the movie, you know, and what's there. So I didn't write it based on the poem or anything like that. It just kind of, I realized like, oh, this is perfect. But I mean, I spend a lot of time thinking about the titles. And so kind of went down a rabbit hole of this. And when I found it, I was like, guys, it's The Pale Door. Like, that's the name of this movie, 100%. So, yeah. And it's, again, I recommend everybody reading it. It's just a really, really creepy poem. So,
yeah, I read it, actually earlier today because I wanted to know more about it and everything. And I now, because of The Simpsons, have to read everything Edgar Allan Poe does in James Earl Jones' voice. It's amazing, like, how that guy, I don't know if he has a style that has a name, you know, like Shakespeare has his own like style or whatever, but Edgar Allan Poe, like, you can see how he writes. It's very, you know, similar in everything that he does. And there's this quality to it that's so much just him, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And he's a storyteller in his poems too. Like, he has this great way of it's little narrative movies in a way, you know. It's just, he sets up this idea and then he pulls the rug out from you. And it's usually in this like really insipid, dark, creepy way. And it's like, oh no, like what? And then it recontextualizes what you read before. And it's just, yeah, he's modern genius, of course, like, you know, but yeah, it was, and then once I realized we could tie this to Edgar Allan Poe, you know, and like, oh, this could be, and like, we should open with the quotes. It just helped on so many levels. I just thought really kind of set the groundwork for what the kind of movie was going to be.
Yeah. Yeah. It turns out perfectly for what you've made here. Right after the genre mixing, you know, that wraps you up into it and everything, the next thing that you notice is, man, there are so many people in this movie that I love. And you know, you've gotten this just ridiculously awesome character actor cast of people that I've seen in the backgrounds mainly of most movies. I guess save for Melora Walters, who I've seen, in bigger roles and everything like that. It was great seeing Melora Walters in a role like this. Noah Segan, we have talked about before, and I definitely have a lot of questions about that dude because I feel like he's probably as funny and cool offset than he is in his characters that he plays. Onset, but Stan Shaw is another guy I hadn't seen forever, and he's great.
Hell yeah. Oh, I love it. I love that. I love
he's
that.
So good.
Because he's been great for so long. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Stan has been overlooked. And I mean, I remembered in Monster Squad, he said such a great little part of Monster Squad, mm-hmm. and like Snake Eyes. And my mom's favorite movies is Fried Green Tomatoes.
Oh yeah.
So, yeah. And I, you know, so I had to watch it so many goddamn times. It's fine. I mean, the movie's a good movie, but like, just as a kid, it's not a movie a kid has to watch.
I'm in the same boat as you. I had to watch it a bunch because of my mother. So.
Yeah. But I remember like my family would always like, that actor there, that guy, that Stan Shaw, he's a good actor. You know, mm-hmm. I remember people saying that. And I remember that as a kid. And so when it came up, you know, we were talking about who could play and we had a list of people. And I went to my casting director and was like, you know, I think Stan Shaw could kill this. I just think he's got, and he's also got this kind of like baritone voice. He comes from a family of musicians and singers. He's a beautiful, he's an amazing voice, mm-hmm. but he can kind of, you know, it all was about the speech that happens in the church with Lester's character and Jake's character played by Devin Druid. And, you know, culminating and knowing what I wanted that speech to be. And that speech was like so important to me that mm-hmm. I was like, when he has to turn on the energy, and he has to like show the pain and the history of that this guy's been through and what he's explaining the realities of the horror to this young boy. Like, I've got to feel it. And when Stan Shaw talks, you fucking feel it. And, you know, and I love it. So yeah, he makes me so happy. And just, he's, God, man, he was such a joy to work with.
Absolutely. I was going to add that you mentioned Monster Squad. He has like one of my all-time favorite line readings, and it's from that movie. It's when he's interviewing the guard at the beginning about the mummy.
Yeah.
And it's just everything about that scene is so perfect. But you know, he's so awesome. This cast is great. I have to say though, like, if I was thinking of casting a modern day Western, Zachary Knighton would probably not have been like someone I would have thought of, but I would have wished I had, because he's pretty great in this.
Yeah.
I knew him basically from Happy Endings.
Me too. Yeah, me too. Yeah. Well, I love that you brought that up. So Noah, so Noah's one of my best friends. I've known Noah. So we met on Starry Eyes. We've known each other for so long. And, you know, he's like, we were talking about different people. And originally it was the character of Dodd had a lot more comedic moments in. He had a lot of jokes. And there's still some jokes that stay in Dodd's side. And Noah and I were talking about people. And he's like, so his wife, Allison Bennett's a writer with Fox right now in FX. And they had a couple shows. And Zachary Knighton was involved in a couple of those shows. And he had gotten to know him. And I was like, you know who would be great is Zach. And I was like, really? Like, well, I love him in Happy Endings. And I really liked him in the Hitcher remake. Like, he was surprisingly good there. I thought he was pretty good. Oh,
that's right. He was the male lead, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, whatever you think of the movie, him and Sean Bean are pretty damn good.
Yeah, no, you're right. I forgot that was him.
Yeah. So I was like, oh my God, you're right. And so he's like, you should talk to him and kind of see what you think. And I was like, well, maybe he could work for Dodd, you know, who has these like comedic timing, let him kind of lean into that, but then go sinister. And I love taking comedic actors and letting them do darker things. So like the spur scene and all that, I thought would be really cool with him. But then as we started kind of getting talking and we were going through this, and I talked to Zach about it. He's like, look, everybody just wants me to be goddamn Ross from Friends and everything. Right. And he's like, I can do more, you know, and I really want to do this. And he wanted to do a Western. He had married someone from Austin, so I had some other ties to him as well. And made this really, really, a couple really small Austin indie films where he just kind of, you know, showed up and just was so sentimental. And I was like, whoa, this guy can do it. And so what ended up happening was we had this big search to find our Jake. And because that was going to be huge, and to find the right person to do that. And I want to talk a lot about Devin Druid, but once we finally settled on Devin Druid, and it's not settled. I mean, he was the guy. Let's put it down. he jumped off the page and it was like, it's Devin Druid. And I was like, you know, crossing my fingers the whole time. Like, I hope he says yes. And we put the offer out and he did. But once we brought him on, I was looking at photos and he has the exact same, these like striking blue eyes as Zach Knighton and the same nose and ears and kind of like facial features. And I was like, he's Duncan. Like, he should play Duncan and he should play his brother. And I went to Zach and was like, hey, like, I think there's an opportunity here. It's a little bit of a smaller part, but it's really poignant in what happens. And how this works. And he was all on board and he reread the script and like thought about it. And I'm really glad he did, because I think it works great. And then their dynamic is so amazing.
Yeah.
And I'm so proud of what they did. They're just so great together.
Well, and then you get to bring Bill Sage in as Dodd. And I mean, he's perfect. I had seen him, of course, on Happ and Leonard. Was that how he kind of got involved? Was he through Lansdale or did you already know him?
So, I mean, I knew that, you know, because he was even the voice in Cold in July and stuff. And
right.
Because he's tied with Jim Mickle. So Jim Mickle, is kind of tied to Lansdale. So that's kind of like an incestuous little trio that they have.
Yeah.
And, but I knew that. But no, Bill was just on my list. So actually what had happened was Dodd was being played by Clifton Collins.
Really?
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah. So Clifton and I spent, you know, hours and hours and hours talking about Dodd and all these different facets and what that was. And I was like, this is a cool dynamic. But then Westworld came in and Jonathan Nolan personally stopped us from casting Clifton Collins in the movie. but it was like, okay, well this, and I was like, well, what about Bill Sage? I'd always wanted Bill Sage, and Clifton had kind of been early on as the guy that was brought forth. And I was like, what about Bill? I can actually go to Bill now. Because originally it was, they wanted to cast these bigger names and all this stuff and, you know, to get more financing. And then once we realized we weren't going to get the more money, I was like, well, I just want to cast the guys that I want, you know. And Clifton was somebody I wanted, don't get me wrong, but he was part of like a bigger cast at that time. And he was a remnant that was staying with us. But then when Westworld, you know, shut that down and said, sorry, we can't do it, I was like, well, Bill Sage. Like, Bill Sage is perfect for this. And I loved him in particular from We Are What We Are. Like, that was the role where he played the father in that, and just he's so brooding and menacing. And he could do so many different things. I mean, Bill's a chameleon, you know, like and I loved him in Happ and Leonard as well. And I mean, he's even in Boiler Room and like all kinds of crazy stuff. Like, Bill's just all over the place. Mm-hmm. And I love it. And I love that I'm always surprised. I'm like, oh my God, that's Bill again. He's an American Psycho. You know, he's in like, like he does all this crazy shit. And once this all kind of happened, David Guglielmo, my casting director, was like, David, like, oh my God, let's do essentially, once I didn't have these parameters on anymore, I was like, let's just do the Avengers of like indie genre actors, you know, and just like go after like all these cool people that I know can do it and kill it.
So that makes sense why Pat Healy's in there now.
Yeah,
of course. I mean, if you're going to do that, I mean, he's, yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know which part he is, but he's like the number one. He's, you know, the Bruce Banner of all this, right? So,
Exactly. You couldn't find Robert Wise? Come on now.
By the way, does Pat Healy just come on set and be like, hey, like, I know you guys are going to fuck with me at some point, so can you just go ahead and tell me what I have to do in this movie? Because I feel like he's always having to like eat something weird or... Yeah. He's getting his head bashed in.
Of course. Of course. I mean, he's so good at it too. I mean, so I met Pat also met through Starry Eyes and had always wanted to work with him and, you know, wanted to find a way. We just couldn't find the timing on other projects. And with this, you know, some of it, I mean, God, first off, like what he did, like that guy built an entire dialect and like the way that he walks, his mannerisms and everything mm-hmm. to be Wiley. You know, just the way that he dresses, the, you know, we wanted a very, you know, kind of specific person to kind of play the strategic member of the gang. Cause the gang's loosely based on the Dalton gang, the real Dalton gang from the 1890s. But we kind of took our own versions of them, but there was one member of that gang who was like all strategy and he was a former banker. And I was like, ooh, that's an interesting character. And that kind of fit for Pat to kind of play this more put together piece, but then also to like unwrap. And he had a little hint of maybe some religious undertones and stuff that could really, once the shit hits the fan, to really let that occultic kind of pieces come in and usurp that as a character. And it was going to be a lot of fun. So, but I will say too, I went to film school with Evan Katz, who made Cheap Thrills.
Mm, wow.
And, Evan's a buddy and wonderful, wonderfully talented filmmaker. And I love Cheap Thrills so much. Mm-hmm. So once we had Pat, I was like, and he did the glass eating scene and what was happening. I was like, look, I want to do this. And we sat there and he does this moment. I'm like, oh my God, this is just like in Cheap Thrills where he's like, I did it, you know, like holding up his hand. And, you know, he has PTSD from that movie. In a wonderful way. It was just such a hard film to make.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, it was just a hard film to make. And so, I mean, I think him and Evan, like, you know, I think they're not Evan, but him and, who played the counterpart with him from, oh my God, why did I just
I blank? Just, I lost the was name. Ethan Embry,
yeah. So him and Ethan Embry, actually, I mean, I think they kind of almost came to blows. So when they're fighting, I think they're kind of fighting in Cheap Thrills. So, But yeah, he knew I was going to put him through the ringer, you know, and he knew that was going to happen. And, you know, had a moment at the end where I'm like, hey, I told my makeup people, David Greathouse and Becky, I'm like, can you give me, I kind of want Sam Neill at the end of Event Horizon here. You know, what's so great too in that scene, talk about just putting Pat through the ringer. Poor Pat, if you listen, I'm so sorry. But the night that this happened, so not to spoil or whatever, but you know, I mean, he can't, let's just say he can't see the makeup that he has and all that's going on. But the lightning struck our generator that night. And he was in makeup, it was hours and hours of makeup to get that done. And he literally can't see. And he's like drinking through straw shit and stuff and whatever. And he's like, Aaron, please tell me like what the hell happened? Like, what is going on? Like, when can I do this scene? Like, oh my God. And I'm like, so Pat, yeah, have a little snafu. You know, it's going to take some time. And he's like squeezing my hand. And I'm like, I know we're hurrying. You know, I felt so bad. But he's such a trooper and was so amazing. And I'm so glad I finally got to work with him. He's just wonderful.
And I said Robert Wise and I meant Ray Wise. And I'm so sorry about that. Just like that's who you should have. That should have been the guy that rounded out your Avengers independent cast is Ray Wise. But
We had too many characters already. But dear God, I would have loved to add Ray Wise into that set. No problem. Yeah. Trust me.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes. So doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
so you were about to talk about Devin Druid, who plays a character. I don't know if I've seen this. I'm sure there's been a million movies that have come out set around the Western, the 1800s and everything like that, but his character is gay, and I don't know if it's kind of an interesting situation scene when he admits that, not in so many words, but mm-hmm. And everything, and Melora Walters' reaction to it and everything. What was the impetus behind his character? How did you create him?
Yeah, I mean, well, so much of this was, you know, as I was going through and watching all these old Westerns and going through, like, one of the things that were kind of frustrating for me, actually, was that the gangs were all these same, you know, white dudes mm-hmm. all the time. But in reality, when you research these gangs, they had a very diverse group of people. Hmm. And you know, there were people who were former slaves that became gang members. There were women that were in gangs. Native Americans were a big part of that. That's why I had Clifton in particular, because I wanted to get, you know, a person like kind of like a Mexican heritage involved as well. So right. I thought there was an opportunity there. So that was part of that whole idea. And then I was like, well, why don't we just continue going with this? Like I had read a story, I can't remember it off the top of my head, but I had read a story that was about like this gay cowboy and mm-hmm. and what it was like. And it was like this great grandson who told a story about his great grandfather and like what had happened. And he had this like secret relationship for so long and so many years. And it was like, you couldn't tell anyone, like nobody was allowed to know about this. And I was like, well, you know, let's explore that. And this is someone who can't tell people, mm-hmm. you know, cause it's not accepted. But also I didn't want it to be hokey. I didn't want it to be like a thing. I wanted it to just to be, this is who this person is. And it's part of what makes him unique from everyone else.
Yeah.
And that he feels different from everyone else. And the weight of dealing with that. And I thought subtly layering in him being gay could be a big part of that. And then we also wanted to play with the innocence mm-hmm. of him being a virgin. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, you know, and when I talked to some people, they were like, everybody was having sex when they were 13, you know, back then. I'm like, okay, well, never mind. That's weird. So they're like, there wouldn't be a virgin that's, you know, 19 years old. I'm like, well, maybe there would if he was gay, you know, maybe right. there's something there, you know? And so there were ways to kind of play with that and kind of build in more of the plausibility of that and make that happen. And it just, and the way Devin played it, and I love that scene with Devin and Melora so much, because she's, you know, that is the, we talked about that a lot of, there's that whole Hitchcock analogy about there's like the bomb that's under the table mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. and during a conversation, it makes that conversation so much more interesting. And I want that to be that. I want us to be ahead of the audience a little bit at this moment, you know, and like knowing like shit's about to happen and you just feel the tension and she's just toying with them. You know, yeah. I talk with Devin a lot about how you are just looking at these threads, these colored threads, and you have no idea what the pattern of the quilt is that's going on here, mm-hmm. you know, and you're just trying to kind of figure this out and find your place. And you want to impress your brother and you want to kind of be a part of something bigger and be more, but you're just not like them. And there's something that's different and your brother doesn't want you to be like them, you know, but yeah. In that moment, for the way that Melora plays it, the way she like leans back in her chair and her like mannerisms with her hand and, you know, and just like, oh, you know, it's just like so yeah. good. Oh, yeah. She's so sinister.
Like,
it's so good.
It's almost, it's weird to say this maybe, but I feel like this is one of her best performances I've ever seen her in, and it's God. Not like I've seen tons and tons. I know she's in a lot of things. Okay. And before this, you know, probably if you asked me, if you said Melora Walters, the first thing that comes to mind is Magnolia, and she's fantastic mm-hmm. in Magnolia. Unfortunately, like I think a lot of that movie, everybody's sort of allowed to go super over the top and everything. And so like the performances are great, but like, you know, there's the slightest bit, if you could give me some of the slightest bit of control here. And this is what I'm getting from this performance here. She's playing this, you know, this witch who has a lot of like, you know, centuries of anger built up and everything. And there's something very cool about her, like very seductive and very, it's one of my favorite performances I've seen her in.
Oh, wow. Well, okay. Let's talk about Melora Walters for a second, because mm-hmm. this is my muse. Okay. My cinematic idol is Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah.
Okay. He is, so 1999, 19 years old. I go to see Magnolia, 3 hour mm-hmm. and 7 minute movie. I'll preface by saying I have a Magnolia tattoo. This is how much that movie
really.
Means. Yeah, I'm obsessed with Magnolia. Magnolia, Boogie Nights, and There Will Be Blood.
No, I love Magnolia. I know that I make it sound like I was disparaging it, but like, you know how Julianne Moore has one of her most over the top.
Oh my God. Oh, by the way, against Pat Healy.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
Pat exactly. Healy in that moment. Oh my where she's God, like,
that's right. Yep,
you know, you yes. can't mix those.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, and she's like, suck my dick to Pat Healy is one of my favorite lines ever.
Yep.
Ever. And wow. Pat and I talked about that. So Pat's known for years, like how much Magnolia's meant to me. Mm-hmm. So I watched that movie, and then her look at the end when John C. Reilly comes to the edge of the bed, yeah. I'm getting chills just thinking about it. And she looks in the camera and she has those tears in her eyes. Mm-hmm. And she looks in the camera, and then it cuts. And then that Amy Mann music starts to play.
Yeah,
I was moved. Right. I was completely moved. I sat there. I was with my girlfriend at the time and 3 other friends. They left. I sat through the whole credits. I was crying. I didn't even know what I saw. I was like, what the fuck was this movie?
Yeah.
I didn't even know what I saw. I came out. They're like, all right, Aaron, are you okay? Like, are you crying? Like, what's wrong with you? And I'm like, guys, I don't know what just happened, but this movie is like mess with me. Like I have to go watch it again. They're like, that was 3 hours and 7 minutes. What is mm-hmm. wrong with you? Or not like what the hell? And I'm like, I'm sorry. Like you guys can go. And we were going to go somewhere, go to dinner or something. I'm like, I literally went back in. I bought a ticket, waited like 20 minutes, and I watched it again back to back.
Oh,
that
man.
That night I decided I was going to go to film school.
Oh really?
And oh, yeah. Wow. So I wrote this part. I don't like to use the same character names. Because I like to address, if I'm addressing Melora for Melora, I'm going to talk to her as Melora. If I'm addressing as Maria as a director, I'm going to talk to her as Maria. Mm-hmm. So I don't like to use the same names, but Melora and Maria just kind of, you know, merged together. So I wrote it for her, and we had a bunch of people who were really interested, and all these names were thrown out at us. And I'm like, nope, Melora Walters. Mm-hmm. Nope. Melora Walters. I wrote her a letter. And I told her, you know, I didn't tell her everything. I didn't want her to think I was crazy about how obsessed I was and how much it meant to me. And then she got to set, and then I was able to tell her, and we formed this like bond since then. So to come full circle and to bring her back, like kind of my film career, is like one of those special things that you couldn't script.
Wow.
And it's amazing. And then another crazy tie. So not only did Pat Healy has a tie to Magnolia through that, but then Melora played the mom in Cam. On Netflix, the Netflix film, and the brother in Cam, who had a bigger part and they had to kind of change it around, was Devin Druid.
Oh.
And so she played Devin Druid's mom in that scene. So I wanted that scene with them to be a very motherly thing. There's actually an Easter egg. And nobody would ever notice this unless I tell you, but if you watch, CinemaSins might notice, Jesus Christ, but, in the background, if you were to pause when the kids are in the opening sequence, there's a chair with this very kind of distinct little knitted thing. It's a weird looking chair that sits there. And then when Jake sits down with Maria, that chair, that exact chair is sitting behind him. And part of this was just to like that what you're seeing was she was kind of creating an environment to make it feel homely. Like that's the lighting's very different in that scene. It's like it feels like you're in a home. You know, it feels different than everything else. And it was to, because witches can kind of play, and I'm in this, well, the witches that I created can kind of play with your perception of this reality. And there's a lot of folklore with that. So I was like, let's just layer in subtle things to make it, like she calls him Jacob.
Yeah.
And when Jacob is what his mother calls him at the beginning. And so there's just like things that we try to kind of like subtly tie, and Melora just being this like unbelievably talented actress. And as much as, so like to hear that kind of made my heart pitter pat, because it's like her part of Magnolia to me is so important. And even I mean, she's great in Butterfly Effect too, by the way, on a side note, like so good in Butterfly Effect.
Right.
The movie's, the movie's wacky. I love the original ending of that movie, though, by the way. It's so fucking crazy.
I'm not sure if I've seen the original ending. We recently got to talk to Eric Bress about Butterfly Effect and his experiences on that. But
oh, wow. Well, the original ending.
I don't
ending,
know if I've seen the original ending.
So the actual original ending of Butterfly, or maybe it's the alternate ending of Butterfly Effect, is because he keeps like going back in time. Mm-hmm. He actually goes to the womb of his mother and then strangles himself with his umbilical cord while inside.
Oh, wait a minute. Oh, that was the one that I saw. Wait a minute. Okay. That I thought for some reason I saw. Okay. I did see that ending. All right. There you go. Yeah. That's a great ending.
That's so wild. Like, yeah. That's so ridiculous. But yeah, she drives that movie, you know, she's the emotional core of that film. And so, yeah, Melora, but I think she's magical in this film. I mean, I know I'm biased, but I do think she's great because she's playing so many layers of what's kind of going on, because it was important to me that this was not a black and white story. This was not good versus evil. This is a mixture of, and I wanted to parallel her story and the origin of the ire and the hate and the violence to the origin of these brothers. Mm-hmm. And that violence creates more violence, and hate creates hate.
You know, I love stories like that. Like I sit here, that's my main thing when I watch movies. A lot of times I'll do that whole thing. Well, did this actor appear with this actor in this movie and so on? Is this a reunion of some sort? That type of thing. And that was what I was thinking, like the one that kept going through my head was Magnolia, because of the Pat Healy, Melora Walters thing. And I was like, I don't know. Cause sometimes, you know, it's just, sometimes it's a coincidence. But in this case, it seems like you're a true Magnolia fan, and you cast those people based on knowing them before.
Yes, which is funny to say Magnolia fan, because I remember the Kevin Smith film, Magnolia fan.
Exactly when I said that, yeah. I was like, if you're a Jay and Silent Bob person, then you know.
Which is so, well, and when that happened, so when that joke happened, I can't tell you how many of my friends were like, oh, Magnolia fan, like pointed at me, like that was me. So yeah, that's a funny thing. Yeah.
I mean, I was too. So, I mean, I understand where people come from when they say it's super pretentious and all that,
sure.
but it's one of the most creative things ever put on film for me. So like, you know,
I honestly think it's still my favorite, Paul Thomas Anderson film, even though, I mean, I have mad respect for stuff he's done since then, but, he's never quite captured that energy for me.
Yeah.
He'll tell you that too. He'll say the same thing, you know, that this was such a weird time in his life. And it'd be hard for him to recreate it. He was so coked out with Fiona Apple and stuff and all that. So like, I think it's like a weird time period, you know, for what that was. He locked himself in a cabin, you know, listening to Amy Mann music. He thought there was a snake outside his cabin the whole time, so he wouldn't leave. And he kept writing at this frenetic pace. And, you know,
I remember he told a story in some interview where, like, when he was with Fiona Apple, she would just leave these journals like everywhere where she would write all this stuff down, and he just said it was just insane, because he would just be like, he would keep like stubbing his toe and stuff on these journals, and then he would read them, and then he would get inspired, you know. And
yeah, I mean, they had a really interesting collaborative relationship. She actually made so Melora, who's an artist, she made a lot of the art that's in the movie, and especially that's at Claudia Gator, her character's house. But the one piece of art that was like this mixed media thing where the but it did happen when the frogs are falling, that was actually something made by Fiona. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow.
I did not know that. I was going to ask you because when I see somebody like Noah Segan, who continually works with someone like you and works with Rian Johnson all the time, there's got to be something sort of special about that guy, right? Like, I know that he's your buddy and everything, but is he as cool as I think he is, offset?
Oh God, I don't want to answer this question in hopes that Noah sees it.
Okay.
And listens to it. Well, no, just because I don't want it to get to his head.
Right.
Because he is like Noah is genuinely like one of the coolest people that I know, and I can't take it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he jokes about being like Warren Oates and all this, and he loves these like 70s stars and all that, and he's just got like. There's just something about Noah. There's like a little interesting swagger that he has. That's just a lot of fun. But one of the things about Noah too is he's so smart and articulate and affable. Like he can play these really goofy characters. Like I wrote Truman for Noah specifically because I knew I wanted the kind of goofy, drunk in the gang in a way, and what that could be. And I know he could play, anything. He can go dead girl dark and he can do this, very easily.
Yeah.
But there was something about his character in Looper. I love the Kid Blue character in Looper. Mm-hmm. And I was like, why don't we lean a little bit into that, in some ways and some of those kind of aspects. And it's great. He got to do the gun twirls. He's like, hey, Ryan and Looper paid for all that gun stuff. Like, let's do the gun twirls. I was like, great. Yeah, let's do them. But Noah's the best and I love him and his wife, his little family's created now. And I've known him for years and he's just a joy. I mean, I want to, either kill or work with Noah in everything I do. So,
yeah.
His character is the one that's like, well, they did say brothel. And I remember when he says stuff like that, I'm always like that. I mean, I don't know him, but that seems like something he would say. Like it fits with him.
Yeah.
It's I got to the point where I know him. So I know what he would say. So I feel like he probably would have improvised that line, but it was written knowing that Noah would probably say that line.
He steals these little moments from a huge cast in Knives Out. Like it's just the being, just kind of, just kind of goofy and whatever. And it's just kind of, he's just a fun dude to watch and everything. And I seeing that how he is on both of you guys' projects all the time, I'm like, this guy must be a dream to work with to keep coming back to him every time.
That's a lot too. The fact that he's one of the most memorable people in Knives Out, I think that says quite a bit about him as an actor and a performer.
My favorite part of that is when they're talking about the books that he's written in the past, the crime stories, and somebody interrupts him. He's like, no, let him finish. Like he's so geeking out over the guy. Him and Ryan are very close as well, and truly like best friends. Like they go everywhere together and everything. Mm-hmm. And so Ryan, like he's just become, his dad jokes are just like incessant all the time. So like clearly they wrote that in and like let him kind of go with that and have a lot of fun. So yeah, it's, you make movies with these people and you find these like-minded folks and you're like, we're just alike, we kind of like have the same sense of humor, the same kind of like ideas, and you start to understand their voices. Mm-hmm. And then you get to do an ensemble like this. You're like, ooh, okay. Yeah. Like I know how I could picture Pat being, I know how, like what I want Dodd to be and what Bill Sage could do. And I know what Noah can do so well. And then Zach came on early, so I got to work with Zach a lot too and talk about his character. So like we were able to kind of curate that in a fun way. And I'm writing up until the night before we're shooting. Like we're changing stuff. We're like looking, I'm feeling things out. I asked the actors to tell me like, what do you like in this moment? Like, does this feel as natural to you? Or how would you want to rephrase this? And how would you want to do this? And a great example of that was Bill Sage, again, who's phenomenal. He had a really emotional moment toward the end with him and Jake. Mm-hmm. And that scene, we had written it and he was like, you know what? I feel like less is more here. And like, I feel like we should do this and this. And him and I were kind of like going back and forth and talking about it. And that was day of, we rewrote that scene and it became what it is. And it's so good. I'm so proud of it. And then what I ended up doing too in that scene was we decided to, originally it was a bigger conversation between him and Jake. And I was like, well, let's let the weight of everything that's happened kind of like wash over him. And we actually ended up removing all dialogue from him in that scene. And he does it all just with his looks. And if you go back and rewatch it, there's like these subtle moments that are happening. And what I wanted to do was connect these characters because Jake's always wearing white and Dodd's always wearing black. Mm-hmm. And early in the film, there's a moment where Jake's innocence is being shown and Dodd's sinister nature is being shown, where he's with a spur with the, the Pinkerton, and Jake runs into the other Pinkerton who's injured and he can't pull the trigger.
Right.
And those are, and we cross-cut those deliberately, which was an idea from my editor, Greg McLennan, which was, I thought, genius. And we cross-cut those two, so that way they start on these opposite ends of the spectrum and they slowly start to come together. And the moment where Dodd really starts to understand Jake, I mean, there's a couple moments when like Jake's like, I got to go back into the brothel kind of thing. And Dodd's like, look at the kid, you know, and he's gaining his respect. But then there's a moment where Lester and Jake are talking and you see Dodd in the background. He knows the truth because maybe, you know, we don't hear all of his dad. I mean, he says he was raised in a brothel. You don't know his whole story, but he clearly has a conflicted relationship with his family.
Yeah.
So when he sees that truth and you see him lower his head in front of the pew in the background, I was like, ooh, now when Dodd starts to tell his story and he talks about losing, you know, what it's like to go through this familial drama, and then Jake turns and he kind of lowers his head, and it just, it brings them together to kind of come out for the finale. And that was like a, you know, you have to curate that. You have to like, and you have to have actors that can pull that off, because it's kind of ambitious to like, because all those beats have to work. You know, the moment with Jake and his brother, like that sentimentality has to work, and Lester and him have to work, and all this. Otherwise, if you get lost in one of those steps along the way, it starts to crumble. And you just have to have actors that are able to kind of pull that off. And they did that.
Well, and I feel like it's got to be kind of a challenge, because I mean, you're already dealing with the challenge of mashing up genres, which is hard, right? Because you've got to kind of keep both sensibilities working, you know, against each other and for each other. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, you're also adding in these rather dramatic scenes that you normally wouldn't find in either one of these types of movies.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think playing with tone. Mm-hmm. So that was something that I think I struggled with more on Camera Obscura, was my tone and playing with how to balance that, because there was kind of this weird dark humor that I wanted to have, but it's also a very serious movie. Then there's like this completely comedic moment, you know, kind of with the hardware guy and stuff. And I was like, and I think I massaged that as well as I could.
the hardware thing is a funny scene. It is funny.
I love that scene. Yeah. I think it's great. Yeah. I love that scene. It's so much fun. Actually, the music to that scene is called Frankenada, which is my homage, you know, to Carpenter's They Live. The fight scene that never ends. So we like named it after that even. But actually, and then that character in that is the lead character in Scare Package.
Oh, really?
So quick aside here. There's actually a whole cinematic universe that exists. So that guy's character's name is Tad Buckley, who owns Tad's Hardware in Camera Obscura.
Yeah.
And then in Scare Package, there's a man named Chad Buckley. played by the same person. And he actually, there's a moment, we do a commercial for it where he's like, well, I got all my brother's murder settlement money, and that's how I got this video store that nobody will get. And that was, his brother gets murdered, so he gets a settlement money in Camera Obscura, so he gets a settlement money. But then in Tad's Hardware, we did a commercial there, and he talks about his great-grandpappy Bill Buckley. Well, his great-grandpappy Bill Buckley in the shootout is the guy who gets shot in the shootout.
Oh, okay.
And that's Bill Buckley. So he's like, and he plays, so it's the same character. So we have, that's Jeremy King, and he plays all of those. And my end game is just to kill Jeremy King in every movie. And then, 10 years from now, I'm going to make a mockumentary called The Buckley Chronicles, and it's all going to come together. So
Go ahead, Chris.
No, it sounds like, you have a lot of fun on the outside of, just aside from just making the movie itself, the actual creation of the movie and a world around it has got to be pretty fun on its own.
If you're not enjoying this, you're in the wrong. I mean, because here's the deal. The movie business is so damn hard, and it just kicks you in the ass all the time. If you can't enjoy the good stuff and have fun with it, you're doing it wrong. You're in the wrong business.
Mm-hmm.
So my whole thing is, don't let the lows get too low, and then celebrate the hell out of the highs.
Yeah.
And when things are good, embrace it and have fun. Work with people you love. And that was, you know, part of a learning experience at Camera Obscura. And now it's become something that's really, really special. You know, and these last two movies, you know, have just been The Pale Door was easily the most difficult film I've ever made, just from the elements and Category 5 tornadoes, hail, flooding.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. Everything that could go wrong. Murphy's Law was a dick on that movie. But because we were working with all these people that like loved each other and were willing to go to kind of like go to battle together, it makes it all worth it. You know, you're willing to like figure out, you know, how to make these things work when shit hits the fan and things are not going the way it is. And you know, you're flooding through and you have to move, you know, sets and you're losing a day because of shooting and you build a blood pit. And we were going to put actors in that blood pit in the movie. And then we were going to, you know, line it and everything and do it all safely. And we had this whole process of doing it. We dug it out. And then that night it flooded. So then the blood pit's covered. And then we're like, okay, well, now, can we line it? We're like, no, it's not really safe. We're like, okay, well, let's still find a way to line it and make it work. But then snakes had gotten in there.
Oh, so we're like,
oh, can't put the actors in there now. But I had already shot the end of the movie and people are covered in blood.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to find a way. So then we like, okay, so like the day before we decide to let's rain blood and like let that tie into the witches and all that. I mean, that's just indie filmmaking, you know, and you just have to roll with those punches. And like Roman Dent is one of my producers, is like out there with Cameron Burns and everybody in there and Ashley, and they're trying to find, you know, all the food coloring in the entire Tri-County area in this small Oklahoma city, like, you know, to like fill a water truck filled with red blood. I mean, it was an ordeal, but if you're working with the people that you love and you're working with people that are like-minded and you're having fun when the tough things are in the good parts, it makes the tough parts able to be bearable.
Yeah.
You know, and you're kind of pushed through them together.
What was it? I am curious what it was like working with the Lansdales. I'm a huge R. Lansdale fan. I've read a lot of his books. I don't know much about his son. Is he written some books too, or screenplays, or?
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, God, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree there.
Yeah,
Keith is so talented. So he's written an X-Files comic, something with like a Batman thing. He's written a couple,
you
a
know what?
Screenplays.
I have totally read some of his stuff. I know what you're talking about now. Yeah,
yeah.
I didn't put two and two together.
He also wrote a Creepshow episode with his dad, the new series. Keith is unbelievably talented and is going to be a massive writer as well. Already kind of is, you know, working his way up. And so they're wonderful. You know, they just have an approach to things that's different. We work very differently in the way that we did it. But because Cameron Burns and I are, you know, we're kind of, you know, like I do kind of the majority of like the story and the outline. And then I give a script to Cam and he kind of makes it kind of feasibly happen and kind of like massages it in the right ways. And I'm more like macro ideas. And then Keith kind of comes in and we're like, Keith, do whatever you want. You know, like here's the things we're struggling with these characters, these beats. And the ending was a big thing. And back to your point about tonally and how to balance this, it was, you know, to have this film and to go as crazy as it does and do some of the set pieces that we have and the absurdity that's there, and do that in a really dark way, but then still have this very sentimental tone that is really about these two brothers and this journey and it, of their kind of, you know, this like idea of letting go of this hate that's in your life that's kind of like created this world that maybe you didn't want to have for yourself, and how to make that work. And Keith was integral in making that happen, because I went even darker as an ending, a very, very dark ending. And Keith's like, look, you have all the groundwork here for this. Like, take this moment. Let's just like go a little further with it. And I actually fought with him at first. I was like, no, this is so cool. And then I slept on it and I thought about it. I was like, whoa, no, this is so much better. Like, this absolutely works. And he was such a great part in making that happen. But I wish, you know, Joe's notes were impeccable and had so many great little ideas and all this. And it was a joy. We're hoping to do more projects together in the future.
Oh, that's cool. I was going to say, I know I've heard rumors about different variations on adaptations of Joe Lansdale's The Drive-In. you would be a perfect director. I don't know if you have any interest in that, but I'm just saying, like, I don't, your sense of like the way the watching something like The Pale Door just made me think like you would nail something like The Drive-In.
I am 100% going to take that little tidbit. I'm going to record it. I'm going to send it to an agent and people.
Please do.
My dream is to make The Drive-In.
Oh,
that is what I want to do. That of all of Joe's books, it's my favorite of his. I think it's amazing. Yes, it's been tied around. There are potential rights. It's just such a big
scope. Was there going to be a musical? Is that right?
Oh my God. I don't even. So all the stories I've heard, even Joe will be like, I don't even know.
Yeah.
Like there were so many iterations, but it was, God, who was the last person to have it? It was, I think it was with the Walking Dead dude, was the last person
that
had it.
That sounds right.
Nicotero? Yeah, but Kirkman. Or maybe it was Kirkman. I think it was Kirkman. Or maybe it was Nicotero. You know what? Again, it all blurs together. So many different people have had variations of it. I know, you know, studios have circled it for a long time. But if I'm going to do a studio film, I want to do the drive-in. I mean, I think it's so ripe. I think it's perfect to be made now. I think it could be such a cool grindhouse. Like, just, I love it. I love that. So yeah, for all the ones you just say, the drive-in would be the dream one to do. So I'm going to take that recording and I'm going to use it to endorse me to direct the drive-in.
It works.
100%.
There are a couple of other actors I want to get into, and then we'll, and I also want to talk about the music in this film too, but.
Oh, great.
Just to round it out here of all the main players, Tina Parker, who people know from Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul as Francesca, the secretary that Bob Odenkirk uses. She's fantastic in this. This was somebody at first I was like, who is that? I know I've seen her before. Mm-hmm. I don't know who it is. And then I looked her up. I was like, oh, yeah, I'm stupid. And she's in Breaking Bad and everything like that. she's fantastic. That's a great little supporting role there.
Love her.
And
Tina's amazing. Yes, Tina is absolutely wonderful. And in fact, I was sent a tape from Tina. So she's a Dallas-based actress. And I was sent a tape from our local casting director. And we were talking about going to some different names and stuff. And then I was just watching and I watched her. I didn't realize that it was her from Breaking Bad either. Mm-hmm. I just saw her take on it. And I was like, that's Brenda. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, this is Brenda. And I was like, why do I recognize her from? And I'm like, oh my God, Better Call Saul. I was blown away. I couldn't believe it. And yeah, Tina's amazing. And just to have that kind of like fun, you know, kind of comedic timing as well. And I love like her and Bill Sage with Dodd had so much fun together. I wanted to build this little subtle sexual chemistry. Like I told them both, I was like, here's the deal. You both have totally done it. But you don't want anybody else to know that you've done it, you know?
Yeah. Because Dodd likes it dirty, right? So yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, actually, there's a scene that was cut that was later. There's another thing. And somebody makes a reference to like there's another like a dirty kind of reference. And then Tina like kind of winks. And that scene got cut. But yeah, no, that's definitely it.
And Natasha Bassett. I feel like I had seen her before and I guess I have. She was in Hail Caesar, but I'm not sure if I've seen her in anything else. But she's got this sort of angelic quality and like the sort of she puts you in a trance. There's something about the way she sort of just like looks at everybody throughout this whole thing. Once the whole seduction of getting you into the town and everything starts, that's just eerie. And everything. And I just wondered sort of how you found her and how she got cast as well.
No, you nailed it. You absolutely nailed it because that's what I wanted. So my whole thing with Pearl for that role, when I talked to David, it was like, we're casting for eyes, you know? And I even said, I want somebody who looks like their eyes look like they're like, you know, roll on applicators of deodorant, you know, that just can kind of like move, that kind of feel like there's something that's there. And when I saw Natasha, just even her headshot, I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. I hope that she has this because if she does, she's perfect. Because I wanted someone that could kind of evoke the innocence and have something that's there, but then have this kind of like she's in control, like she's like learning this whole world. And there's, you know, there's a little subtle hints, you know, for like why she's there and what's going on and was she meant to be captured or not, or who had it or what. And, you know, cause when she goes to Melora or to Maria, you know, when they get there, it's like, you know, it's like, it's her birthday. It's like, did you like your present, you know, and stuff like that. And so there's a lot of things where she's kind of in this like beautiful world and taking it all in and trying to figure out what her powers are or aren't in that place. And she has a lot of bruises when she's in the box, but then when she gets to the town, her bruises are completely gone, you know, and subtle things like that, that we kind of layer in. But I cast Natasha for her eyes and what she could do looking around a room and just kind of like bringing you in. And she's so beautiful, but had this sinister kind of undertone to her. And I thought it played off really, really well with what I knew, you know, Melora would be doing as Maria. So it was like finding that balance. But yes, the eyes, like that's it. That's what it was all about.
Very stark, like just very memorable in that sort of exactly whatever effect that you wanted there, you got it. I was going to talk about the composer. Alex Cuervo is your composer on this. And there are some there's some score in here that I really like, because there was, I can't remember. I think it's there's a fight or something going on in the saloon. Of course, there's a lot of fights going on in the saloon at some point, but there's like a Western tinged electronic score thing that's going on in there. And I just was like, oh my gosh, this is really cool. This is like, I'm like, did they get somebody like really well known for this? And this guy is not very well known, but I get the sense that we will know him in the next few years.
He's a superstar. Alex Cuervo is a superstar. And he's been scoring most of my work. I couldn't work with him on Camera Obscura because I couldn't work with all the people I wanted to work with on that movie. Mm-hmm. Even though I got Steve Moore, who's amazing. Yeah, so that was great. But no, Alex did Scare Package as well. And so we had a unique challenge. So I wanted to do, my whole thing was, I was like, well, let's have this like kind of, because Morricone, people think of like the big pastiche Morricone scores, but he does a lot of these subtle kind of brooding Morricone stuff, like in The Mission, where he uses weird instruments.
Yeah.
And then his score on The Thing.
The Thing, which is always trips me out every time I pop in The Thing and I see his name on the composer. It's like, what, really? It's not Carpenter, it's Morricone doing a Carpenter, and it's awesome.
Well, and it's so great. So like, that was such a big aspect of this. But then we also challenged ourselves where we used all organic instruments. So, I mean, we used the piano. That was the only other thing that was there. But like, I mean, we had a horn that we used that was a femur bone that Alex was like blowing into a femur bone to make.
Oh, really?
All the clicky clacky kind of sounds are antlers, like different types of antlers that he's like striking together. The big bassy stuff that sounds like it's more electronic is actually a bass harmonica.
Oh.
That is this like, and it's like 5 feet like large. It's this massive, oversized harmonica, bass harmonica, and it makes this really low droney kind of feel.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, everything. I mean, even our guitar was a biscuit tin guitar that was made. The violin stuff was on barbed wire. So it was, you know, we just really wanted to go at it. And I knew, like, Alex is a good friend of mine, and I know his sensibilities. He's obsessed with witch stuff. In fact, the opening credits stuff that has all this witch iconography in the credits, all of that are like drawings that he personally had.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
That he kept over the years. And like, you know, some of them were like 1800s drawings and stuff, but he just like had this collection of them. He's like, oh, you need witch shit? Yeah, here, dude. Here's a file of like a gigabyte of just like witch shit. I'm like, oh my God. So I knew that he had this in him, you know, and he mainly does electronic stuff. In other aspects, like the Scare Package score is very, you know, Carpenter-esque electronic score. But I was like, let's decompose this. Let's break this down and do this kind of thing with like a hint of like a Philip Glass or a Max Richter, Hans Zimmer, you know, kind of aspects.
Yeah.
But just do it all with, I mean, our cello was a shipping box, you know, like, I mean, everything was just find unique ways because it gave unique sounds to the instruments and it made it feel of era. While still being modern, still modernize it in the way that we did it. I'm obsessed with the score. It's being released on Lakeshore Records.
Yeah.
Lakeshore, like, they're so excited. They're like, hey, we're going to put this up for a Grammy. I'm like, fuck, okay, great. Yeah. You know, I mean, that won't happen, but still, you know, I'm super, super. And I'm someone who too, I mean, I used to collect film scores as a kid, you know, like film scores are such a huge deal to me. So, you know, and he scored the hell out of this. I mean, like the whole movie scored.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not a lot of like quiet, I mean, there's quiet moments, but even the quiet moments have subtle score going on. So yeah, I'm super proud of the score. Alex killed it. And I think he's going to be a superstar.
There are people, you know, on the Syncast who are more musically inclined than I am. A lot of times I'll watch a movie and I'll kind of notice a score here and there, but it's usually gotta be something that's really just standout before I do it, because most I feel like, and I could be completely wrong, and composers do so many movies in a year that not all of them are like their best scores, you know, they're doing something that's good enough for the film. And whenever I notice a score, I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. This is really, really good. Who did this? And I have to know, you know, and I'm glad that this is a superstar in waiting. I'll be waiting to see in the next few years, seeing his name on a lot of movies.
Well, look, if we can get the drive-in done, he'll be scoring the drive-in. So,
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, he'll do whatever I do.
So, we'll just make an announcement here that the drive-in will be directed by Aaron B. Koontz, and Alex Cuervo is composing it. And I'm glad that we could force that through. Yeah. And, you know, we've got awesome power here at the Sincast.
Amazing. I'm indebted for life. Let's do it. Special thanks in the credits. Sincast.
Jonathan, do you have any more questions for Aaron?
No, I think we've covered the gamut with the cast and the score and everything. It was a really fun movie, man. I had a blast. I had a blast with Scare Package too. I think both of these were really fun. You've clearly got a love for the different genres, and that's not always a great thing, I've noticed with some filmmakers, but you definitely make it work. So I really had a fun with this movie.
Oh no, thank you so much. And yeah, I mean, we're, you know, our whole thing is to challenge ourselves to make things that we haven't seen a lot of. So like one of the things we're working on now is, so it's going to be horror. We're going to have horror as like the starting point for whatever it is we're doing. I was like, well, what have I never seen before? So I was like, well, I've never seen a horror sports movie. So we're making a movie called, we're writing it out called Demon Derby. That's a horror comedy sports movie.
Oh my God. And
it's kind of like Glow meets Evil Dead 2 or something.
Oh my God.
But it's all done with like, we're going to, you know, Rocky style kind of beats. So, you know, it's going to have like it's going to be full of montages, like so many montages. but culminate in this kind of like the way the sports movie arc is. So we do that, you know, and it'll still be sentimental. It'll still have that rising, you know, like against the odds kind of thing. But done, played seriously as a sports movie, but then also be this completely over the top horror comedy within it.
So, definitely would love to see that.
Yeah, I can't think of anything, right? I mean, like, there's been like, you know, like you've got like slasher films that are set, like with, like you've got Graduation Days or, you know, Track and Field Team and Fatal Games. Speaking of which, though, if you can bring back the javelin speared football from Graduation Day, I think that would be a plus.
So on Scare Package, we talked about it. I wanted to happen.
Yeah.
When they did the kills with the werewolves, but unfortunately I wasn't there. But yeah, no, it's I would love to do that. And yeah, just the idea of like the sports arc, the tropes of a sports movie, like tone in that, done in that framework, but then against, you know, like this demonic roller derby team that becomes like beyond Thunderdome, you know, so I mean, that's what's fun. And we just want to make, you know, fun movies, you know, and in different aspects. I think hopefully The Pale Door's fun. And I know Scare Package is fun. I know that because it's just like, it's hard not to smile, you know, at least even if meta horror is not your thing, it's like hard not to at least smile what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And Pale Door is a very, you know, again, it's a very serious movie, but we want it to be an enjoyable ride, you know? And I think there's something there. So as long as we're making fun, you know, having fun with the horror genre, we're going to continue doing it. And the drive-in's a perfect fit for that.
Yeah,
so. Absolutely. Yeah, that's what I'm saying after watching those two movies and then Lansdale being involved in this, I was just like, God, that just makes way too much sense for it not to happen.
I agree.
All right. So the Pale Door comes out August 21st in theaters and on demand. And I'm assuming theaters, you just alluded to, drive-ins are in play there. But August 21st for that and Scare Package, which we've talked about a bunch on this too, is October 20th is a Blu-ray and it's on Shudder right now. If you want to see it there. And everything.
Yeah.
But thanks a lot, Aaron, for coming in and giving us your time. I love talking about movies. I love talking about the process and everything. And you gave us a whole, you know, wealth of information there. And I love it. I'm glad that you came on.
No, thank you. Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun to kind of be here. And and now I'll look forward if you do a Cinema Sins and then we can talk separately about that. Yeah, I know.
We'll just
know,
have
guys.
You do it. You know, you've already volunteered to do the Cinema Sins, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I know what free. They are. Yeah.
Here, there's so many... my job for me.
That's directing. Yeah.
Yeah. we'd like to thank Aaron B. Koontz again for coming on to the Sincast. And we can be reached at our usual social media stuff and everything like that. But that's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkinson and Jonathan Watkins. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.
All right, guys, you know what? You want to join the Sin Club? This is how you do this. You need to get on Patreon and go to patreon.com/CinemaSins because you can get stuff early. You can get, you can get videos early. You can get podcasts early. There's even some tiers where you can get a bonus video that nobody else gets to see. There's two bonus podcasts. Like recently, what did we do? We did Overlord for a Sins video. We did a couple of podcasts. Question was asked, what movie from your childhood could you not watch again? So on and so forth. On CinemaSins, we answered questions that had been lingering, and we went ahead and answered those and everything. So get on our Patreon and take a look at the tiers and see what's best for you. These are just sort of our thank you to all of our members and everything that we're giving this extra content. And there's even stuff like you can choose podcast topics. You can get discounts on merch. We give you some handwritten notes. There's some discounts on fan events. There's all sorts of little things that you can get into from membership. So go to patreon.com/CinemaSins and check it out.